Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, Cinema Clash has a busy night tonight, a loaded night tonight. Six films, two of which are Hollywood blockbusters, two of which are foreign, one Oscar-nominated, and two smaller indies, and what, 10 short films? The Oscar-nominated animated and live-action short films. But you brought the wine tonight, and I haven't seen it yet because you're playing Hide the Wine. I haven't tasted it yet. What are we drinking?
Well, you can taste it while I tell you. I had so many to choose from this week because of the number of movies we were doing. Mm. But just one jumped out at me, and it's even a little costlier.
It's good.
It's a good one. But it is called Zinfomaniac. It's a zin, and it's in honor of the very first movie we're going to talk about tonight.
You know, for a minute there, I thought it could be about Bex, but it's not.
It could be about a lot of things. There is a love and a entangled love theme going on tonight, but Zinfomaniac is sort of a reference to the, let's just say, the prolific nature of sex scenes in our first film.
So just 2 weeks ago, we had a trilogy wrap-up from The Maze Runner, and it stunk. And now we have another trilogy wrapping up, 50 Shades Freed. They've been releasing one of these every year for the past 3 years on Valentine's Day weekend. They want the couple money, and it stinks.
Well, I think there was 2 years between the first and the second.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was like 20.
Because I know they switched directors.
It was like 2015 for 50 Shades of Grey, and then we had to wait. So then 2017 and 2018 were back-to-back because they shot them concurrently.
Oh, how time flies.
Doesn't it, though?
I think I know your opinion on already where this fits in. My opinion is, I believe this, while the film is garbage, complete and utter trash, I think it's the best one.
And the thing is that the people who think this is the best film are the ones who did not read the book.
No, I didn't read the book. I've heard about The Inner Goddess.
There are three books, and that's how you know that somebody hasn't read them if they only refer to the first one.
The reason I say this is number one is not because of the idiot plot or the 2x4 acting. It's because there's more 50 Shades in it. The women lined up at Barnes & Noble to buy these installments because there's some stuff going on in there that doesn't usually get printed in your standard romance novels. It goes above and beyond.
It's kinky.
And this one went above and beyond on the sex scenes.
Yes.
They advertised themselves so fully that, ooh, come, it'll be so scandalous. And the first two were not scandalous. There was strategic bedsheet placement. There was more talking about what Christian was going to do to Anastasia Steele than what Christian actually did to Anastasia Steele. And somewhat in this film, he does those things. And every now and then they get back to the plot, which is just ridiculous.
It is. But if you know the plot in the books, you fill in so many gaps. And that was my problem with this film, is that it just did not serve the plot that is buried within those three books between all of the sex scenes. And they're left out. The plot points are actually left out of this movie. The character development that does exist within the books is left out of this movie. And so I think it's going to be disappointing to the fans of the books who we're hoping for a little more of the emotional pull and the motivations and understanding the character arcs that just doesn't come through in here. They sort of jump ahead to this place where there's, you know, Anastasia and Christian are married. They definitely still like to get it on wherever they happen to be, in the kitchen, in the car,
in the bathroom.
And then they're sort of being tracked by this guy, Jack Hyde, who's sort of the villain in this movie.
Sort of.
Yeah, he's the villain, but he doesn't even really
register. No, the villain hardly registers. It's a very poorly written script.
It is.
And I heard the books are also poorly written. But what I did notice is that our main characters, Anastasia and Christian, actually are evolving as characters, something I didn't think was possible for these films. Christian is actually more of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
He is singing Paul McCartney at a piano, something he would not have done. He's still a sociopath, barging into her office the day after the honeymoon. Why haven't you changed your name on your work voicemail yet? And she's evolving. She's confident. She stares down and straight up threatens this woman architect coming out of her dress who's ogling Christian. And then after a car chase, they get it on in an Audi sports car. She initiated it.
Yeah,
so she's evolving.
It's important to note that she initiates just as much as he does throughout this film. And that really was part of where this series of books takes you, where people who only knew about the first one thought it was all about the sort of, the whole domination thing that the guy Christian was into before he met Anna. And so there is some evolvement there. But Jamie Dornan as Christian Grey was always sort of the sore spot for a lot of folks because he was not the original choice for casting of Christian Grey. Dakota Johnson was always fine. She kind of grew on me in this role. I thought she's probably the better actress. But Jamie Dornan is not most people's vision necessarily of Christian Grey. And this movie, the acting was very inconsistent. There were some scenes where I thought they were doing really well and other scenes where I felt that they were just phoning it in and it didn't have any emotional pull, very little chemistry. And so for me, as someone who did read the books, who was looking forward to just getting the closure on this whole thing, it was a disappointing end.
There have never been any emotional investments in any of these three movies.
I think they
have not been good.
No, but I think there was an emotional investment on the part of the fans of the books who had read them and were invested in watching these movies, which is why even though these movies have averaged 10 to 20% on Rotten Tomatoes, all three of them over the past 5 years, it doesn't matter. It's that 20%, 10, 15, 20% that these movies are for. They're not for anyone else. I mean, really, seriously, if you have not read the books, if you did not see the first two films, there is absolutely zero reason to go see this one.
These movies would be more believable, more coherent, and honestly more honest if it was straight up hardcore pornography.
And I'm the opposite way, is I think if they had moved away from the soft pornography that this movie really contains and stuck with more of the characters and the plot. Marcia Gay Harden, for heaven's sake, she's like given
3 seconds
in this film and yet is in the credits, is pretty high up in the credits.
If they were going to do this, move away from what that is and focus on the story, they would need to hire an actual writer.
Well, they would have needed to hire an actual writer and they should have combined. I always felt that this should not have been three films, that it should have been the second and third books should have been one solid movie. And I think that they would have gotten a lot more bang for their buck, so to speak. And they didn't do that. And now it's over and people can move on and no judging.
Well, I will not be surprised 15 years from now when 50 Shades update comes out. I just won't be sure.
It very well might with a very different Christian Grey. And I do think that someday this will be recast, written better, and who knows, maybe we will see it again.
What a shame. Now for something completely different. Let's talk about a kid's film.
Because, who breeds more than Christian and Anna?
Rabbits. And even though there was a baby at our 50 Shades screening, there'll be lots of babies at your Peter Rabbit screening if you go there. That's a good transition. Who breeds more than Christian Grey? An update to Peter Rabbit. Beatrice Potter created these characters, including her most famous one, Peter, in like 1902. And these were stories that took place on the farm. Well, not in 2018. Yeah, they're still technically on the farm, but now it's more physical comedy, slapstick. People get hurt. It's zany. It's about revenge.
Yeah, it's irreverent for a animated kids movie.
The dynamic is Peter steals vegetables from Mr. McGregor's garden. Mr. McGregor waves around his hoe angry and he gets upset. That's their kind of dynamic. Well, in the very beginning of this movie, Mr. McGregor has a heart attack and dies. That's what kind of movie we're talking about. And his great nephew, that we just saw in Star Wars The Last Jedi, Donal Gleason moves in. He just wants to flip the house, get back to London, but he notices his next-door neighbor, Rose Byrne. Oh, good Lord.
Which is the reason
good Lord.
You went to see this film.
And Peter Rabbit has an edible complex for Rose Byrne. She's kind of like his surrogate mommy. So there's a love triangle with a rabbit as one of the ends of the triangle. It's not bad. My kid loved this movie, you know, because, you know, they're throwing vegetables at each other. There's dynamite explosions, and it's funny at parts. But yeah, it's a 2018 Peter Rabbit update.
Yeah, I don't think that Beatrix Potter had things like, I think there were lines in there like, that'll do, pig, you know, which is the play on Babe. And maybe something like, you want a piece of me, something like that was in there. And James Corden as the voice of Peter Rabbit is a great choice. I mean, you could see James Corden beneath the eyes of this particular rabbit and the sarcasm and the you could just almost see how much fun he must have had in the audio booth just reciting these lines. As an adult there, I was not all that enamored with this movie. Thank goodness it was this swanky updated theater with reclining seats that made you feel like you were on the bridge of the USS Enterprise or something. But it was, for most people, if you're not taking a kid, you're not really necessarily going to need to see this film.
I noticed that Peter Rabbit is oddly written particularly well because at certain points, it's psychologically aware of itself. Peter Rabbit says, I know it's stupid to run into the garden with no plan and steal vegetables. It's my character flaw. And your character flaw, Benjamin Bunny, is that you chase after me blindingly. Mm-hmm. And the guy who sells rabbit traps at the hardware store says, you know, I think B has an unnatural anthropological, or, you know, the animore, whatever the word is, attachment to these rabbits. And you're like, wow, that's really deep.
Self-aware.
You know, and it's like, that's interesting. It comes out every now and then. And, you know, kid, that's going to sail right over the children's heads.
Absolutely. And the kids seem to enjoy it mostly for the physical comedy bits. And when I come out of these movies and people ask whether it was good, I go, you know what? If the kids enjoyed it and that's really who this is for, then it's a successful movie. And your kid's 5, I would say yes, you know, 4 to 8, maybe 9 would get a kick out of this movie.
A little high on that maybe, 9, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, but, you know, adults will still get, there are certain things that are thrown in there for the adults, but it is not, it's not one of those animated movies that you go, oh, it just, but it really works on two different levels and adults can appreciate it on a whole different level. It's
no.
Like, no, you'll survive it more because of what's thrown in for the adults, but it does not make it a movie that adults will necessarily be entertained by.
But something that does work is the interaction between the live action actors and their animated computer generated counterparts. That's seamless.
It is. You would never know. You start to forget that
yeah,
there
you
is
forget
that
these aren't, you know, these are animated rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Our next film is an Oscar nominee. An Oscar nominee for the second week in a row for Best Foreign Film, this time out of Chile. A Fantastic Woman. Una Mujer Fantastica. And I voted for this movie. I nominated it in the DC Awards because I put it in my top 5. It's like number 5. Because there's a brand new face on the scene, and her name is Daniela Vega, and she carries this movie. She's in every scene, and she's a beautiful singer, and at the beginning of the movie, she is in love. She's in love. It's a love story. They're at dinner. They're planning their future. She's in love with Orlando, and that night, Orlando dies. And I don't pay attention to certain things every now and then. I didn't notice something about Daniela Vega. No, not until the hospital and the family shows up and she gets ostracized. Daniela Vega is transgender. She was passing for me.
It took you till the hospital?
Like through the whole dinner scene. I had no idea.
Wow.
I had no idea. She was passing for me. Huh. And, you know, if you see the previews, you already know going in. But I don't watch previews. And that's this is an interesting experiment. I didn't watch the preview, went in. That was a woman to me.
I didn't watch the preview, so I didn't know that, but I recognized right away that maybe it's because I had just seen Kinky Boots on Broadway, and so I already had in my head like this, you've already kind of been ready to embrace and empathize with the transgender community, And so I think that might have made me a little more aware, and so I recognized it a lot faster. And I mean, the fact that Daniela Vega is truly a transgender actor, it made her much more, very convincing. And it's a quiet, powerful sort of film. Definitely art house movie, though.
It is. I like the director. I remember him from 2013. He hit it big with Gloria, starring Paulina Garcia. Both these films are actually quite similar in that they're about women and love and relationships, which don't work out for various reasons. So the director is Sebastian Lelio. These back-to-back films are quite good. And I just felt such empathy for Marina. Daniela Vega's playing Marina. That, she's a human being, this beautiful singer, but she is somewhat relentlessly attacked because she still has this attachment to her love. And, the family wants nothing to do with her now that Orlando's out of the way, and it spurs all these questions. Why does rejection, discrimination, and violence follow this wonderful person? Who gets to determine what is and is not legitimate? What types of love are allowed? Those sort of questions are what are being explored here.
Absolutely. But the other side of the coin is his family. He had left his family. So he was married with a child when he...
Well, child as in grown-ass man.
Yeah. Well, but it's not really clear how long they had been divorced. But he had left his conventional family. And I guess, and entered into this relationship with this much younger transgender woman.
There's an age difference.
There's a big age difference. And so there's the resentment there's the resentment that's not just about the transgender aspect, but also about the fact that this person took away this older gentleman from their lives. And so part of his family was more accepting because they recognized that Orlando truly loved her. But since they had never gotten married, the legalities, it was an interesting exploration when they're in the hospital and she's not technically next of kin and what she entitled to. And then there's a police investigation because, there's just that automatic, is there something suspicious? Did she attack him in some way? So it's just an interesting exploration of a lot of themes, and it does what I think it sets out to do, which is just make you empathize with this woman's plight and with the prejudices that she has to face and with just how strong and determined she remains throughout this thing. She does carry the whole film. It is a very quiet movie, and while it's not normally really my thing, my cup of tea, I definitely... I liked it, not as much as, way more than The Square, if I were thinking about the other nominations for foreign language film, but not as much as, say, like The Insult that we talked about last week.
There's also a bit of magical realism in this film. Not everything you see on screen, I think, is actually happening in the real world. She's walking down the street and encounters this like gale force wind that she leans like 45 degrees into, and I think that's just a metaphor for everything she's dealing with. And there's a portion in the nightclub. There's like this dance music scene, and she all of a sudden spurts out of the crowd and just stares at the camera. But there's a wonderful scene where she gets on top of a Volvo and jumps up and down on it. So there's some really good, it was a very well shot film. Our next film is a bit more
bad,
contemplative. It's from Austria, and we know the director, Michael Haneke. This is my fifth Haneke film. He just won the Oscar in 2013 with Amour. You remember Amour?
Vaguely.
And before that, he was nominated for The White Ribbon. He did Cachet in the mid-2000s. In the early 2000s, he did The Piano Teacher. A lot of Isabelle Huppert in those movies. And she's back. And so is Jean-Louis Trintignant. He was the guy in Amour who ended up, mercifully killing his wife. And he kind of might have done that. There's some similarities between his characters, between these films. So Happy End is somewhat of an ambiguous but perhaps ironic title because this family is not particularly happy. In fact, this is your cliche bourgeois French family who is rich but miserable. But is this perhaps a realistic view? And I think you just watched this today. Is this a realistic view of a family?
I hope not. Because, I mean, the 13-year-old's a sociopath who, like, kills
many
her 13-year-olds
hamster. Many 13-year-olds
are. Who, like, kills her hamster and probably killed her mother. So, you know, most 13-year-olds, no, I hope not. I love Isabelle Huppert. I mean, she definitely is one of those actresses that has captured my attention over the past 2 years, and her performances are always great. So the performances in this movie are all very good, but I did not like this movie. Happy End is I think it is meant to be a sarcastic title. This family is morose and they're flawed. Everybody's flawed, and they just do not. I just didn't like it.
I don't think you thought it was boring and didn't like it, because there's actually not a lot of plot in it. It is very much character driven, and it reminded me of Cachet. The camera sits back, like far back, and watches things happen in the background. There's a fight between two guys outside of an apartment building, and any other movie would have zoomed up right in there, and maybe you would have heard the sound effects of punching and maybe some glass breaking. Here, you don't hear a thing, because the camera's staring way far back. And I wonder, you know, this family is just, they operate in a closed environment, and they are just deaf and dumb to the rest of the world around them. Like, remember the opening scene where there's a construction accident that kind of sets in motion the rest of the film? We're not there. In fact, you don't hear it, and it happens way in the background. It's that camera staring again.
Yeah, there's a lot of camera staring in this film. I just was like, okay, I think even it took maybe 6 or 7 minutes to even get off of what was it starts with cell phone footage. So it's
and it might be saying something about the world,
right?
About
shot
that
vertically, so you're really annoyed at that. I just was like, turn the phone sideways, but you don't really know at that point whose phone it is, who they're pointing the phone at. There's texting going on. You don't really know the source of them. And this film definitely will make you really just question how much technology you use and how much you should delete if you've got a smart teenager in the house who knows how to hack your computers and your cell phones. And
it's also set in Calais, which is, you know, been all over the news for the amount of refugees just sitting in Calais trying to get over to England. And there are other, I don't know, Hanukkah mentions in other parts of the films about the haves versus have-nots. This is a director who makes his audience, he does not give them answers. He gives them lots of questions, and he always makes his audiences guess.
Yeah, which I'm all for
that ain't your
guessing,
cup of tea.
But I usually want it wrapped up a little more. So once you've figured it out, the resolution needs to pay off for me. It was too slow throughout the whole thing, and it's a downer. Ultimately, it's just a downer, and I think you just, if you're not in the mood for a downer, slow plotting theme, and I think you need to like, if you like this director already, then it's probably more tolerable. It did not make the final cut, I believe, for the Oscar foreign language films,
but
it was
why. It's not.
Right, but it was in the mix.
I'm sure it was Austria's submission.
It was Austria's submission, and I could easily see why it did not go further than that, because I just don't think it's got much mass appeal.
Now, if you know Hanukkah, you know, from his last 5 films or so, you have to see it. It's just, you know, what you do. But if you have not, or maybe you've only seen Amore because it won the Oscar, no, go see A Fantastic Woman. Stay away from this thing.
But isn't that also what I said about 50 Shades? That if you've seen the others, you kind of just need to see the last one? Because that's what people do if you're...
No, people do it because it's the new film out and they want to kill a couple hours on a Saturday.
Maybe, but I would say absolutely if I had to choose between Happy End and Fantastic Woman, I would send people to Fantastic Woman in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. It's not even a close choice there. All right, our next bit, we're also going to talk about the Oscar-nominated short films. Next week, we'll talk about the docs. This year, we'll start with the animateds.
This week.
And, you know, the animateds are usually, most of them are like 5 to 7 minutes long, and usually you get one that's about 20. The winner here this year is about 29 minutes long. And we've already seen one. We saw Lou before, one of the Pixar movies. I don't remember which one it was. Maybe Coco?
I don't know. I didn't.
Well, I don't know. You didn't see my...
Because Coco was the whole big controversy over them trying to show that Frozen short.
Yeah, I remember I saw Lou in front of some Pixar movie.
See, I hadn't, so it was new to me.
You know, there's one here fronted and voiced by Kobe Bryant called Dear Basketball, about his what basketball did for him for his life and how appreciative of it. It's like a love letter to basketball. The long one is Revolting Rhymes. It's just a different take on Mother Goose. My favorite is from France, and it's called Garden Party. And it's really about frogs, you know, hopping around this empty house. And as they hop around, you get more information about what this house is or was. It looks like this Tony Montana Scarface drug dealer's, you know, paradise.
Mansion.
After the fact. Like something has happened and you're kind of getting bits and clues as frogs hop around and butterflies flutter and of what happened at this house, this mansion, this mini palace, really. And it's so well done. It keeps its cards close to its chest after a while. And I don't think it'll win. But I fell in love with that little... And it was only like 7 minutes long.
Well, I knew you would because it's kind of twisted. It was like it gets... There's a very sort of deranged, demented ending to this particular 7 minutes.
What was your favorite?
So I think... Well, Garden Party visually, though, I must say, is quite stunning. And the only dialogue is like the occasional ribbit.
Yeah.
That's all you get. And maybe like birds chirping or something in the background. But Lou, I think, has the edge in terms of the Disney Pixar total package that just always, and it's got a theme, a message about bullying. So I think that one has the edge. Revolting Rhymes was like longer than all the other four combined, and that was that weird fairy tale one. Did not, I wanted to bail after 8 minutes. I got
very bored.
I wasn't
connecting with that either. It's an alternate take on Red Riding Hood and Snow White. And
yeah, just sort of grim fairy tale type thing. And that one was to me an immediate discount. All the other four, because the fourth one, the one you didn't mention, was called Negative Space.
My second favorite, by the way.
And that one, it just sort of sticks with you a little more. It's also another one that's kind of a downer, but has a really sweet message about like this father-son bonding and how this father had taught the son how to pack his suitcase when he'd go off on business to make sure there's no negative space, like to really make the most of every nook and cranny in this guy's suitcase.
And artistically, it looks, just, you know, from my naked, untrained eye, that negative space must have been the hardest to do.
Yeah, it's stop motion animation, and it really was just a powerful 5.5 minutes. But I also liked Dear Basketball has a really good message for kids and for basketball fans, and the fact that if it is Kobe Bryant kind of narrating this love letter to basketball, it's like thanking basketball for turning the 6-year-old dreams into a reality, but also recognizing that he had to, at some point, he needed to move on from the sport, that he just really couldn't do this anymore, but basketball had taken him everywhere he was meant to go. And there was a quote at the end of the credits that I love, and it just sums up the message in short of this entire film, which is, there is power in understanding the journey of others to help create your own. And that's really what this film, this little 5-minute
and it's like
homage
sketches.
Is.
These,
it's sketches.
The artist
it's like
sketches.
Hand-drawn.
But it's a lot.
And the only color is the jersey that he's wearing. And so I actually, between Dear Basketball, Garden Party, Lou, and Negative Space, I liked all four of them for very different reasons.
If we were playing what I think will win Oscar night, I disagree with you. I think it's going to be Dear Basketball. It's got that feeling on it.
I don't know. It's tough. I would still think that Lou has the edge because I think more people will have seen Lou. If the Academy voters truly watch all these shorts,
they'd pick Garden
then
Party.
They probably would pick Garden Party in terms of visually.
Gorgeous.
I just think Garden Party is visually probably the best one. Dear Basketball is just a different message movie. It is amazing what they pack into a 5 to 7 minute short. And
right. Especially Negative Space. Five minutes and you get all that?
Yeah.
That's deeper than 50 Shades.
Negative Space is deeper. But yeah, I would say if I had to guess that Lou has the edge as a Disney Pixar movie, and that Garden Party could be, I don't know, we could be surprised.
We'll split here. I'm gonna keep my money on Dear Basketball here.
If there are enough deranged Academy voters, then Garden Party might appeal to them.
All right, what I noticed about the live-action short films this year is that 4 out of the 5 are based on true stories. DeKalb Elementary is a, you know, it's a fictional take on what could have been a school massacre, but it was about a guy walking in to an elementary school with an assault rifle. The Silent Child is a fictional story, but it's a message film about, this is, you know, deaf children are not stupid, they're just deaf, and how to better teach them. My Nephew Emmett, it's about Emmett Till. And Watu Wote, All of Us, is about a bus trip in northern Kenya where militants force everybody off the bus, but the Muslims covered for the Christians, and they didn't tell who was Muslim and who was Christian. That's not new. I've seen a version of that a couple years ago. My favorite, the one that really hit me the hardest, one I just thought was the most well done, was My Nephew Emmett. That one struck a chord. It's about the last pretty much day in the light that someone saw Emmett Till alive. It's told from the point of view of his uncle, because Emmett Till's from Chicago, and he's spending, you know, a couple weeks down in Mississippi. Why he would do that in the 1955s, I don't know. It's a very sad story, especially what we know from last year, that woman coming forward saying she lied. So there's a lot of baggage along with this film, and I just think, man, My Nephew Emmett's a strong film.
It's strong. It might win just because it's still a story that just resonates, but it's nothing I haven't seen before. So where you talk about how Watu Wote's story, you know, the Kenya story that you've heard or seen.
Yeah, I've seen that before in a short film as well.
But I've seen very similar things with about Emmett Till and with the documentaries about Emmett Till. And I recently had gone to the, if you go to the Museum of African American History, Emmett Till's great original casket is actually in an exhibit in a room there that's a very revered space. And the story is playing in the background as well. And you read about how his mother insisted on an open casket because he just looked so, she wanted the world to see what had happened to this 14-year-old and how brutally he was lynched and murdered in Mississippi. And so to me, I knew the story, and so I wasn't really...
I knew the story, but not from that point of view.
It's a perspective movie because you really don't... There's no graphic violence. You're not actually seeing what happens.
It's suspenseful. You can feel it coming.
Yeah, there is a tension that you feel that is palpable. I think if I had to guess, though, I might give the edge to DeKalb Elementary about this elementary school... shooting that's foiled in Atlanta, because the performances are great. Like the woman who plays this receptionist at the school, who basically keeps her cool and talks this guy, this intruder with a gun, into surrendering to the police. I just think the performances and all the school shootings and everything that goes on with that right now will potentially resonate with the Academy voters. And so another is based on an actual 911 call that happened, that came in during that time. And so to me, that's the one out of the based on true events and true stories that resonates most for our time right now. And the performance, I just thought, of the receptionist woman was just excellent. But beside all that, though, what about the one we haven't talked about?
It's we have not talked about the 11 o'clock because it's garbage.
Oh, see.
It's garbage.
I loved it.
It's so stupid.
I loved it. And it's only 13 minutes long.
It was 13 minutes of agony.
No, I love that one.
There's a twist. There's a quirk.
There's a great there's that a
you
twist.
That you pick up on the first minute, and it drags it out because you know what's going to happen. See, and it could be cleared up in 10 yeah, seconds I by totally, the guy pointing at a picture.
I totally disagree.
It could be this cleared one, up with, no, look at the names on the diploma.
This one was about the writing. And,
so
and the, it was funny. It was the only one out of all of these where I was like, just a moment to have a breath of fresh air.
You liked it because it was light.
It was light, but it wasn't just light. It wasn't dumb. I mean, it's about a psychiatrist whose next patient is a guy who thinks he's a psychiatrist.
It's a who's on first joke. Who's on first? Well, what? What's on second?
It is.
It's that stupid joke.
It's a stupid joke that people love, and it's stood the test of time.
Oh, God.
So I found this to be very clever. They talk in circles. You know, the patient's driving the psychiatrist crazy because, you know, it's like who's analyzing who here. And then there's this interesting twist at the end that whether or not you pick up on it.
It's just not believable.
Not believable.
No,
come on,
it would
never
happen.
It's a skit.
It's stupid.
No,
if it was Saturday Night Live skit, I would hate that Saturday Night Live skit.
And I would be like, oh, that was cute. Because it was well written. If it was really poorly written, it would be a completely different story. But I just liked it. I'm not saying I'd vote for it. I would still vote for probably DeKalb Elementary or my nephew Emmett over this. But you know, hey, you gotta lighten up, dude.
I'm all about levity. There was a lot of levity in Garden Party.
There's no
levity. It's just not a very, I don't know,
levity.
It just got under my nerves.
The only dialogue is ribbit. What kind of levity do you
That's what's funny about it. All right, last week I forced some films on you.
Yes.
Before We Vanish, a Japanese sci-fi film, and Dim the Fluorescence, a very, very indie film. And this week you got your revenge. You forced two, in fact, forced films on me. So why and how did you feel and why did you were so insistent that I watch a movie called Bex?
Did you watch it?
I did.
Oh, okay. So one, I was trying to have you watch it as redemption for having you watch the next one, the final one that we'll be talking about.
Oh, we'll get to that.
Because I was like, all right, really? No, this one is so much better than the other one. And I thought you would have liked it because both have musical overtones, both movies.
I love how you say it.
Musical overtones. But Bex is this indie musical drama, and it's inspired by this real-life singer-songwriter named Alyssa Robbins who, you know, it's her songs and her music really track with her life. And so the story is this Brooklyn musician named Bex, who's played by this Broadway singer, Lena Hall, who's very good. And it's another one of these lesbian movies where she has this crushing breakup with her girlfriend and ends up moving back in with her very Catholic mother, played by Christine Lottie, who I really like, in the Midwest. And so it's about where her trying to turn her life around and get back on track. And she ends up basically giving guitar lessons and then a whole lot more to the wife of her high school nemesis. But I just thought it was a really different kind of indie drama. And I was just captivated by it. I thought it was really good.
Hannah, I love this movie. I love this movie. Bex is... blew me out of the water. I did not want to watch this movie. And to co-directors Daniel Powell and Elizabeth Rohrbaugh. Good Lord. You know, I'm watching the movie. It's like, you know, this is very well written. And it's just, mm-hmm. I like the story. And I really like Lena Hall. And oh my God, Mina Suvari, where have you been?
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen you since like American Beauty. And then I just couldn't grasp why I was really loving this movie so much. And then I figured it out. It is so well directed.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've really seen a movie just directed by the scenes run the appropriate length that they should. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think, oh, the scenes were long. They're not. They're the length they need to be. And you know, the camera will just sit there and let it play out and show you the action that needs to occur. Most other directors would have chopped this up a bit more edits. And, you know, when she sings songs, she sings the song.
Yeah.
From beginning to end. And when she cries from beginning to end. And good Lord, Hannah, this movie is good.
I know. I am so relieved because I was like, I just knew. I'm watching it and I'm going, Charlie has to watch this movie. I mean, I even like you mistakenly did. Sent the marketer guy an email that was meant for you where I said, you must watch. And then I was like, crap, I sent it to the wrong person. And I emailed him back. I said, I meant that for Charlie because he must watch this movie before the podcast because I know what you like.
You can tell. And yeah,
you were so wrong last week with what you thought I would like. But in this case, I knew. I'm like, you worried me for a minute there because you were keeping it close to the vest, I know. But I was like, if Charlie does not like this movie, then I do not get it. I do not understand what he likes because I knew that it was more –
It's thoughtful.
It's a slow burn.
And it
but
cares
very
about its characters.
It's authentic and raw.
It's honest.
It's very honest. And so it's – definitely, it's way more arty than mainstream, but I was still cool with it. It's just one of those ones where I'm like, I'm very cool with this movie, and it manages to straddle that line. So it's going to be – might be difficult for people to find.
It's actually got a theater here in town.
Yeah, so it's out there, but it's called Bex, and it's worth looking for because it really is just a good movie. And unlike the next one
– Hannah – what are you doing to me? You made me watch a movie called Basmati Blues. And this is honest to God, one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. Brie Larson made a movie way back in like 2014, 2015. It got shelved because people saw it and they knew they can't release this stupid movie. And then she got famous. And people were like, well, if you release a movie with Brie Larson, you know, above the fold, we might fool some people into seeing it. And unfortunately, people are going to get fooled into seeing this stupid movie.
Well, because it's not just Brie Larson. It's Donald Sutherland.
I thought you were going to say, it's Scott Bakula.
No, it's Donald Sutherland and Tyne Daly and Scott Bakula all singing at various points throughout this film.
Donald Sutherland sings.
Donald Sutherland breaks into song. Yeah, it's a talky singing kind of
It's a
thing.
White savior from America with her genetically modified rice are going to screw over poor Indian farmers with something called Rice 9, which is a direct ripoff from Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle Ice 9, which ruins the world. How subtle. There's a love triangle. She's fallen in love with like the nice guy. But the bad guy is kind of coming off as the good guy. And what a pile of garbage.
But it was so funny. It was so entertaining to watch. One, because I knew I was going to make you watch it. Ugh. And that just made my day.
The problem is, you hurt Bex. You sent this to me first. And then you sent Bex to me 2 days later.
That's when the
And
order,
I was already so mad at you.
That was the order in which I had watched them. And so I knew you'd forgive me to some degree if I followed up Basmati Blues with Bex. But Basmati Blues, what will get people to maybe see this movie on an airplane or just on regular cable TV at some point down the line is Brie Larson, who everyone came to know and love from Room, where she won an Oscar. And she's just so likable. And a lot of people are just learning that she was actually sort of this pop music princess before she did the acting, and she can sing.
She can sing very well. We know that from Scott Pilgrim versus the World. She sang in that movie very well. And she sings very well in this movie.
But it's
this
cheesy.
Movie is it's, one of the worst written, and above it is, that, it's one of the worst edited movies I've ever seen.
Well, it's what kills it is the stereotyping. The stuff with in India
terrible.
Is the stereotypical overtones are just awful.
She gets on a white horse to save the Indians from themselves.
There's really no defense of this movie, but it's this musical comedy romance drama in the vein of this cheesy yet oddly captivating Hallmark Lifetime meets Bollywood movie. Oh. So, you know, you might catch some scenes on YouTube.
You just say, you got me back. All right, you got me back.
I got
We're
you
even.
Back. But it was so entertaining in a horrifying sort of way. And sometimes it was just ironic to me that I was thinking, oh, she was in Room, which, you know, really just was so, so powerful. And then I thought about The Room that The Disaster Artist was based on.
The Room is better than this.
And I thought, I know you're going to like The Room more than you like Basmati Blues. I mean, it is you know, I know that somebody has got to be really wishing this movie got totally buried and
Brie
lost.
Brie Larson.
Including Brie Larson. Maybe Donald Sutherland. Tyne Daly, hopefully. Scott Bakula.
Scott Bakula's like, I'm back. Go see this movie. I'm back.
He's like, yeah, it's like a zap out of into another character or something. But it's... Yeah, it just, there's no real defense. I did read one review that said it rides the line between charming and embarrassing. And that's, I think that really does sum it up, is that it's charming in moments and embarrassing in total.
It's embarrassing for all involved. It's just a terrible movie. All right, we talked about a lot of different types of films tonight. The big blockbusters, the Oscar-nominated foreign films, the short films, and the indies. And above all, my favorite one, not by far, there is a close second, but my favorite film this week is A Fantastic Woman, starring Daniela Vega. I just think if you had to pick between all these this weekend and you pick that one, you're going to be okay. But honestly, a real close second is Out of Nowhere, Bex.
Yeah, so I agree. I hate to say it. I think 50 Shades Freed, you got to see it if you've seen the other two.
No, you don't.
You do. You need closure.
No, you have closure.
You need to close.
It's more the same and it
stinks. You need to close the book on it. But in terms of something really good, yes, I would say that A Fantastic Woman and Bex probably would be my top picks. Worth noting, we did not see Clint Eastwood's 1517 to Paris.
Because on purpose, because they didn't show
it
to us.
They didn't show it to us. I did talk to somebody who saw it last week who really liked it. So, or
wow,
no,
that's the minority right there.
I think it was just because it's based on a true story. I think people like the story. And the movie was secondary to just knowing that these guys were heroes and people just like to salute heroes. Winchester with Helen Mirren, it opened cold last week. And I talked to some folks who actually really liked that one. So sometimes...
And it's 10% on Rotten Tomatoes.
And it's 10% on Rotten Tomatoes. But so
who do you know?
Yeah. So, well, people who just like things for different reasons. I mean, that's really what movies are all about. And that's why, you know... Peter Rabbit will do okay with the kids.
50 Shades will win the weekend.
Do you think?
Yeah, oh, I guarantee you. You want to make a? You can make
yeah,
a.
I don't know. I already gave bang. You the. I'm going to give you the Zinfomaniac wine in advance.
It's really good. I'm enjoying it.
It is very good. So that I'm paying off the bet regardless.
All right. Well, everyone, this has been a wild ride. I'm glad I got Hannah pretty good on that Bex one. I set her up on purpose.
Well, I'm glad I introduced you to it.
So, all right. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, thank you for listening. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.